Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the release of the final report of the Regional Migration Study Group, a joint effort between the Migration Policy Institute and the Wilson Center. The title of the report, and I am sure that you have seen that there are reports outside for you to take along, is Thinking Regionally to Compete Globally, Leveraging Migration and Human Capital in the United States, Mexico, and Central America. This has been an effort that has lasted a bit over 2 years, and it has tried to sort of rethink how the relationships within the region, including the migration relationship, but perhaps even more importantly, the development and growth within the region. This way, the region can compete more successfully in an increasingly difficult and competitive global world, might become better, much better, over the next decade and beyond. The key words here are regional and migration. We need to do something, and in order to do so, we actually started by looking at the migration status quo, its causes, its consequences, and then we try to peer in its future. But we did so through a regional lens. Long-term solutions to the problems that have divided parts of the region and the United States can only be found in the region, and the United States is part of that region. And for migration in the future to be a matter of choice, not desperation, and in order to make it a non-issue, the same way that migration from so many other parts of the world are non-issues, it seems to us that it must be overwhelmingly legal, orderly, and safe. And we also think that in the future, people who migrate within the region must increasingly have the skills and qualifications that can help them succeed, can help their families and households grow, and can take the migration issue as an issue off of the policy and political agenda for the region. Of course, getting there from here requires an awful lot of work on all of our parts. Economic growth must be sustained. Political stability and enduring. The rule of law must develop even more roots. Social development must continue to grow. Borders must have integrity. And we have dealt, of course, they must be dealt with more efficiently. And we need to do this together as neighbors. And personal security must become the first priority of governments in the region. We can do those things individually as countries, as people of different countries, and I am certain that we will do so. But I think that we can do it together as a region. And this is really what it is that this regional migration study group has tried to do. It argues that investing systematically in the region, in building up its human capital, can produce a better future for all of the peoples of the region in a competitive world that will require much better prepared workers. What we are going to do today is we're going to have almost a parade of important people who have invested an awful lot of their time and their political capital to address these issues. We're going to start with President Zedillo, who has a video message that we're going to play in about half a minute. And that is going to be followed by Secretary Gutierrez, who is going to speak to some of the recommendations of the report regarding immigration reform here, but always thinking that immigration reform must get into the lifeblood of the region rather than simply be something that the United States has to do. His remarks are going to be followed by Vice President Eduardo Stein, who will talk about some of the key issues in the region. And interspersed between these remarks, we're going to have our own Doris Meissner, and I think I saw Andrew, and Andrew Seeley, who just came back in, to sort of pick up some of the comments that they would like to make. Then we're going to hear from Ambassador Jones. He's had a great deal of experience on the key issues of the report, not just the U.S.-Mexico relationship, but a keen interest in education. And then we're going to hear from Luis Rubio, who, of course, we all know is one of the public intellectuals extraordinaire in the region. At the end of this hour and or so of presentations, I will try to sum up a little bit and then open it up to questions. Once more, good morning, and thank you very much for coming.
Dear friends, I truly regret that long-standing commitments do not allow me to be with you for today's presentation of the final report of the Regional Migration Study Group. Notwithstanding my inability to be with you in person at this significant event, I want, if only through this means, to express my deep satisfaction for the work done. The report is of enormous relevance, not only for its sound content, but, and I want to stress this, also for its timing. When the study group first met in February of 2011, little did we know that towards the end of our work horizon, circumstances would change drastically for the better, making the possibility of a significant immigration reform in the United States more likely than it has been in many years. Given the robustness of the analysis and policy recommendations contained in the report, its publication now, right at the start of what promises to be a hopeful period of debate and decision on this important subject, conveys significant value. I am confident the participants in that debate will appreciate that our study has done much to map adequately the profound economic, demographic, and societal forces that are reshaping our increasingly interconnected region, comprised of the United States, Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. The study has also taken great strides toward developing and articulating an innovative and collaborative approach to migration and human capital development that, if implemented, can help build a stronger social an economic foundation for our region. Our deliberations at meetings in Washington, Mexico, and Central America, along with the research undertaken in nearly 20 background reports, were ultimately intended to produce recommendations based on a sufficient understanding of on-the-ground political, economic, and social realities in this incredibly diverse part of the world. Aiming to balance policy ambition with realism and intellectual humility, we have tried to give practical answers to the fundamental questions of how can our nations collaborate to ensure safe, legal, and orderly migration flows, and how can they each work towards sustained, inclusive economic growth supported by people with the skills and qualifications demanded by the labor market. The study group's final report, above all, seeks to promote policies that will benefit each of the countries examined as well as the region collectively, but not to advantage any country over the other. For the overall region, one thing is clear. Getting migration policy right is vital to long-term stability, prosperity, and competitiveness in a fast-changing global economy. I am hopeful that the document submitted today for your consideration will earn a place as an important reference in the ongoing debate that it will help governments of the region to execute sound policies on migration, labor markets, and human capital for the sake of their own national development interests. I express my deep gratitude to all of my fellow commissioners for their committed guidance, in particular to my esteemed co-chairs and friends, Secretary Carlos Gutierrez and Vice President Eduardo Stein. Of course, I want to recognize the great work done by the dedicated group of experts and support staff from the Migration Policy Institute and the invaluable intellectual leadership provided all along by Andrew Selly, Doris Meissner, and Demetri Papademetriou. Let us now work hard to give our report the extensive dissemination it deserves and make it an influential tool to advance the cause of good migration policies for growth and development in our countries. Thank you very much.
Doris.
Thank you very much, Dimitri, and I should say thank you, President Zedillo, one of our three co-chairs. President Zedillo started us off in the way that he typically has done in his public service as well as his work in this endeavor, and that is by really touching on the key themes in a very coherent fashion, because this has been an effort that is very expansive. And we're talking about very big themes here, very long-term commitments and efforts. But nonetheless, things have to start somewhere at some time. And these very important issues of how migration really fits within the broader context of well-being for each of our countries as well as for the region overall is what it is that we've tried to get our arms around and begin to point to in this effort. Now, President Zedillo talked about the fortunate elements of timing. Timing definitely fell in a way that we would never have been able to anticipate when we began this effort several years ago. But where the timing is concerned, I do want to stress that we all realize that what it is that is going on in the United States at the present time with immigration reform and the immigration reform debate being again, after many years on the front burner, is something that the United States does have to solve domestically on its own. We are very much recognizing the individual characters of each of our countries and our political systems. At the same time, whatever it is that we do in the United States on immigration policy and on fixing the brokenness of the immigration system in the United States, whatever we do will have critical implications for the region, for our relationships within the region, and for the futures of all of our countries in North America. So it's trying to deal with this, the sovereign nations and what each of us are doing in our nations, but the fact that we are, as President Zedillo said, interconnected, and these are ultimately themes that deal with all of us. I'm turning now, though, to our second co-chair, Carlos Gutierrez, as a person who recognizes that and has been involved in that broad set of issues, but is also very familiar with the domestic debate and discussion. After a successful business career, he served in the Bush II administration as Secretary of Commerce, and in that capacity, he and Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of DHS, were the point people in 2006 and 2007 for immigration reform in the United States. He's continued to remain very active and interested in the issues within his party as well as nationally, and so we're very pleased that he's been part of this effort, and I'm very pleased to be able to introduce him and ask him to come to the podium at this time. Secretary Gutierrez.
Good morning. Let me just start by saying this is the perfect moment to be talking about migration and more broadly about a new vision for greater prosperity and competitiveness in the region. This week, the Senate will begin marking up bipartisan immigration legislation that the U.S. very much needs in order to make the U.S. immigration system more responsive to economic conditions and labor market needs, and very importantly, to make the U.S. more competitive. I want to emphasize one thing, that is immigration reform will create more jobs for American citizens. And I will repeat that. Immigration reform will create more jobs for American citizens. As you know, President Obama has just returned from a meeting with presidents of Mexico and Costa Rica, in which he and his counterparts emphasized the enormous economic and human interconnectedness of the region. They agreed to move forward with a number of education initiatives that are also in our report. We believe there's a lot more to do in the future. First of all, we have 52 million individuals of Hispanic heritage living in the United States. 36% were born in another country. Of those Hispanics who were born in another country, around 14 million, a little more than 14 million, were born in Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras. That means that 3 out of 4 come from those 4 countries. Persons born in these countries make up a bit more than 35% of total immigration, the total immigrant population, and a little more than 4% of the total population in the U.S. Some of the recommendations that we make in our report are in the Senate immigration bill, and we certainly hope that they remain there as the legislation makes its way through Congress and to the President's desk. We believe that the immigration proposal that has been started in the Senate by the Group of Eight is very positive. It's the right thing to do, and we need to move forward. We are looking beyond this legislation. We are looking down the road 10, 20, 30 years, and looking at the changes that will happen in our region, and making certain recommendations beyond what is in the legislation. And I'll give you a few examples. We recommend exploring small pilot programs in which the federal government could work in partnership with states and localities to create special preference visas as part of vetted economic development plans in areas of the country that are depopulating and wish to attract new workers. For example, Detroit, where the city has lost 25% of its population. At the same time, the study group believes that any new program or visa should include incentives for what we call positive circularity. That is, encourage more back and forth movements that allow migrants to pursue opportunities on either side of the border following the ebbs and flows of demand. Today, we think of immigration too one-dimensionally. There is only one path for immigrants, and that is either you go for citizenship or you're not a real immigrant. We believe that the future is a lot more about strategic circularity, where people spend time in a country, in a given job, with special skills that that country needs, and then they can circulate back to their country. And that is more of the future that we foresee looking down the road 10, 20, 30 years from now, instead of a static one size fits all. Not everyone wants citizenship. What people do want is the opportunity to grow, to work, to contribute, and to make the region more competitive. All of these measures should be reviewed on an ongoing basis by an independent, nonpartisan federal agency tasked continually with assessing labor market conditions and making recommendations to Congress and the executive branch on adjusting visa levels. Finally, let me just say, in 1970, Mexican women had on the average 7 children. In 2010, that number is a little bit higher than 2. So there will come a point in the not too distant future that Mexico becomes an immigrant receiving country. Very different to what it's been over the past decades. So we recommend that Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador also update and modernize their immigration systems. We also believe that we should all have a shared accountability for border security and enforcement. Thank you.
Well, Secretary Gutierrez has given us some of the key ideas that have to do with the U.S. immigration system and then what the possible feedback loops or resonance for those changes would be within the region. I think what we're trying to stress very heavily in this work and in this report is really changing the incentive structure, changing the dynamics of migration in the region so that migration is an issue of legality, it's orderly, it is based on principles of fairness. Certainly, it's safe as compared to the perils of the way migration takes place today, and in that way, there is a respect for rights and a basis on which to observe and enforce rights. But the point that was made about positive circularity, and I like that term, positive circularity, as compared with simply circularity, is one that I want to really emphasize in terms of the way in which we could look at a different future. Because the way that we've understood circularity typically in this country and in the field of migration has been seasonal circularity. People coming for several months, picking crops, going back, remittances flowing, and all of the things that go with that that have been, by definition, very difficult. Because that kind of circularity tends to create a very unequal relationship between employer and worker. It tends to be workers who have no other chances or choices in their own societies, in their own communities. And a great deal of the discussion and talk about migration has not focused on the difficulties that surround that traditional form of circularity, what happens in home communities, the difficulty of enforcing the rights of workers. The kind of circularity that Secretary Gutierrez is referring to and the kind of positive circularity that is envisioned in this work and, I think, in the way that many provisions of the current proposed Senate bill outline is a circularity that is really more in the realm of mobility. Mobility that has to do with a range of skills, economic needs and human capital capabilities that cross the skills spectrum, choices, movement and opportunity for people that are based on their own growth and on the growth of economies where it is that opportunities exist. So that one of the things that we hope will come out of this work and one of the things to which we are committed at the Migration Policy Institute and the Wilson Center is to use this work as a catalyst among our countries for developing the kinds of training programs and the kinds of workforce and educational investments that will allow for positive circularity as compared with traditional circularity, which has tended to be limited and ultimately does not contribute in nearly as full a way to broader development outcomes as migration could contribute. So with that as an additional, dimension to what it is that we're talking about here, I'd like to turn to our third co-chair, Vice President Eduardo Stein, who served as Vice President of Guatemala, and we're, I think, all happy to say, has been in a less formal way returned to service for his current government, where he serves as an advisor and has been very deeply involved in bringing the next generation of Guatemalan leaders forward. Vice President Stein.
Muy buenos días a todas, a todos. One of the strategic elements that as a study group we wanted to put forward at the very beginning was how to move away from a gatekeeper's approach and go deeply into a network approach, because we could not tackle the problems and the complexities of migration agendas in this region with the sole perspective of how to control the flows. And also because we could not approach them, and that's another perspective in the richness of the report, only from the perspective of migration specifically. But we needed to look at other issues as well. However, the other quote-unquote issues are so complex in themselves as well that it's like walking barefoot on broken glass. And that's why the efforts that the different talents that were summoned to work at the study group tried to approach this whole set of perspectives from a very detailed study of what had happened in the region in the recent decades. Secondly, what was changing in the region in the recent years? And I want to quote a few lines from the summary. The long-standing assumption that Mexico and Central America have an endless supply of less educated workers for routine, physically demanding, and poorly paid jobs in the United States is becoming less and less accurate when it comes to Mexico and in the years ahead, with right reforms for much of Central America. So I want to begin as well by emphasizing that the countries of Central America face a unique set of circumstances. We have some important success stories to talk about today, but for each success, we also have to recognize an ongoing challenge. First and foremost, I want to point out that there is no one simple story about Central American development. Indeed, our countries are highly interconnected in many ways, and we face a number of common challenges and opportunities, migration being just one of them. But that said, trends are uneven within the region. For example, Guatemala has been experiencing a relatively high GDP growth since 2008, and since that Great Recession, in addition to continuing strong population growth, compared to, for example, El Salvador's recent experience of lower GDP growth and very low population growth as compared to Honduras or Guatemala. Just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, 30 years or younger is 70% of the population of Honduras or Guatemala. So we are very, very young countries with very, very few opportunities for a sustainable job. The most important thing, though, is our ability to generate those opportunities for our people. Indeed, there has been promising job creation in economic sectors such as hospitality, agriculture, and call centers. However, all of these countries confront a common challenge: creating enough formal sector jobs with benefits and wages that can sustain families. With the idea in mind that southeastern Mexico and all of Central America concentrate more than 13% of the biodiversity of the world, just in Panama specifically, there are more birds species than in all of the United States and Canada put together. The trend in not only conserving biodiversity, but taking advantage of it for productive and export purposes has taken hold in Guatemala, Honduras, and Salvador, and in controlled characteristics of greenhouse methodologies, 10-meter by 100-meter facility can give way for a good sustainable income of a 5 to 6 member family per year. And yet, less than 30,000 hectares are dedicated to this type of technological advancements in these type of productive efforts. Fewer people in the Northern Triangle now live in extreme poverty, is true. But for many families, this is because they are receiving remittances from their relatives abroad, rather than because they are earning better wages. And perhaps most importantly for what we're talking about today, educational attainment has risen in Central America. But we're all aware of the fact that we need to improve the quality and the relevance of education at all levels, increase student retention in secondary schools, and expand access to high-quality post-secondary educations for those who qualify. But in particular, we all need to make sure we are giving our students the tools they need to succeed in the real world. This means general communication and critical thinking skills, as well as the specific technical and, yes, English language skills that the modern labor market demands. English is taught everywhere in Central America, but only in private schools. I also want to point out that after dramatic increases in insecurity, homicide, and other violent crime over the last 5 or 6 years, homicide rates in Guatemala and Salvador have finally begun to decrease recently since 2009. As we all understand, violence both reflects and is fueled by institutional weakness and high levels of corruption and impunity in our countries. So we know what we have to do in order to do better by our people, the challenges and the opportunity for both the region's peoples and its governments is continuing and strengthening political stability, economic, social, and institutional reforms, and, of course, working closely within the region to offer alternatives for migration to our people. In the study group's long-term vision, migration will be a real choice for them, rather than a necessity. But until we get to that point, migration will have to continue to be part of the answer, and we need to work together with our partners in the region to make sure that such migration is legal, orderly, and safe. Guatemala and El Salvador were taking important steps on judicial and police reform. It is slow, it is difficult, it has proven to be complex and cumbersome, but it is crucial work. In Honduras, for other reasons, the police reform is facing daunting challenges. These are the long-term solutions that will help us all, not just as individual countries, but also as a region, to instill confidence and trust in our public institutions, to create real incentives for everyone to follow the rule of law, and in so doing, tackle the very serious crime and security challenges that are most destructive to those who have the fewest defenses against them. Just one simple note about my own country, Guatemala. Close to 60% of Guatemalans belong to 22 different linguistic groups, mostly of Mayan origin. We as a country and we as a society have had a long-standing policy in place for 400 years already of discrimination and exclusion. So this is another dimension, perhaps, to Guatemala, but still very important to overcome, because they indeed have every right for citizenship within their own country. We've also made great strides to working together with the region. The study group has noted with approval Mexican efforts to work more closely with Guatemala by issuing temporary border crossing cards for those who wish to visit, shop, and work in southern border communities. We encourage Mexico to continue to consult closely with its neighbors to the south, like it did in developing its recent migration legislation, as it comes to terms with all that this important role entails. Mexico indeed has already become a receiving state for Hondurans, Guatemalans, and Salvadorians. Although the Northern Triangle countries face difficult road ahead in surmounting these challenges, what we want to underscore today is that though each country must continue to address its own internal issues, it is now more important than ever that we continue to build trust with each other and with Mexico and with the United States, and commit to collaborative measures that can help solve these regional problems. Lastly, we believe that the next phase of a regional relationship that is already strong starts with the acknowledgement that the United States, Mexico, and Central American countries, can shape a future in which working together brings benefits to each other and to them as a whole and to the region that are much larger than the sum of individual efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Let me acknowledge quickly the Director and Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Latin American Program and Director of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute, and six or seven board members from the Wilson Center here, including Lázaro Cárdenas, who's a member of the study group as well. Let me, as you have heard already, I think from numerous speakers, we are generally, the study group is generally very supportive of what's going on, quite supportive of what's going on in terms of the immigration debate in the United States. I don't think when we started this, we could have planned the timing better. Most of the study group recommendations that have to do with domestic reform in the United States have already been picked up in one way or another in the current debate, and hopefully this report will have something to say in communication with some of those discussions that are going on. But I have to say, study group members have been very enthusiastic about what they see. Largely, however, this study looks at some of the larger issues. I mean, we have a strong sense the larger questions of migration we're only beginning to come to terms with. We tend to think of migration as part of a problem that needs to be solved, and solved either in U.S. law or solved in Mexico and Central America by stopping people from leaving. But I think the central argument you'll find in this report is that migration is actually a central part of competitiveness and job creation in all of the countries in the region. And in the long term, how we choose to manage this, beyond what happens in the U.S. immigration reform debate, beyond specific changes that may happen in Mexico or Central America, is how we come to terms together across this region in managing migration will have a great deal to do with how we create jobs in the future in all of the countries. This is a long-term question. It is something that will continue beyond the debate in the United States, and it's something that will continue beyond specific debates going on now in Mexico and Central America. You will hear next from Luis Rubio. Luis Rubio is president of CIDAC. He's one of Mexico's most insightful commentators, writers, academics, and thinkers. He will talk to you a little bit about the growth of the middle class in Mexico and the changes in Mexico. I think let me presage that by saying one of the things that makes this debate possible now, not only do we have a debate going on in the United States about immigration reform that is very positive, that is something we can be hopeful about, but also in Mexico and Central America, as you heard from Vice President Stein and you'll hear from Dr. Rubio, things are changing very fast, and they're changing in positive directions. You have a growing middle class in Mexico. You have growing educational levels in Mexico. You have steady growth, economic growth over time. You have a containment of violence, though not yet a drop in violence in Mexico, but a containment, which is a step forward. And as Vice President Stein says, with every step forward, there's a new challenge. And you have a huge drop in unauthorized migration from Mexico. All of these speak about a changing country next door and changing countries in Central America. And this is a fundamental part of the piece of why we can have this regional conversation now, together with the fact that we're having a serious conversation in the United States about our own legal reform.
Thanks, Andrew. As the report emphatically establishes, the U.S. immigration debate on reform is clearly a sovereign concern. But it should not miss the changes that are taking place south of the border and that might be critical for the competitiveness of the region as a whole. These changes have had an enormous impact on the rapidly changing patterns of migration in the last several years, not only in the numbers, but also in the type of migrants that move, where they go to, why they do so, and in one word, the past is very different from the present, and it will be very different from the future. As to the changes, the most important one is the one that Andrew just mentioned, which is that Mexico is rapidly becoming a middle-class country. It is no longer the poor country of old, even though there are many poor people in the country. And less poor people means, or people with more disposable incomes to do other things, people who are more content, people who have better ways of dealing with their normal challenges of life, are people who have less incentive to migrate. The middle class has grown for many reasons, but above all for the following. First, because there has been financial stability, which means lower interest rates, which means an almost virtual zero fiscal deficit and very low debt. Because trade liberalization has meant for Mexicans that the proportion of their disposable income that they spend on things like foodstuffs, basic staples in general, clothing, shoes and the like has come down dramatically because they are no longer bound by domestic producers limited by no competition. NAFTA has helped to strengthen the economy, creating much better paying jobs. It has also contributed in a decisive way to the competitiveness of the region, particularly in critical industries for the U.S., like the automobile industry, like electronics. Remittances have lifted the incomes of many Mexicans, but particularly in the rural areas where everybody used to associate poor peasants with the rural areas. Today, there's an emerging middle class in those areas. And not less important, political democratization and decentralization have transformed the overall picture of the country. Mexico is also undergoing a very dramatic demographic transition, which means that the population growth is much slower. It also means that living standards can improve quite more rapidly. And inevitably that means that there will be an impact on lower migration eventually. In one word, there has been an extraordinary process of change in Mexico, and as we just heard from Vice President Stein, in the region in general. None of this, of course, reduces the size of the challenges or the daunting nature of some of them, particularly in areas like security, the rule of law, impunity and accountability. As Mexico has decentralized politically, it found that its police structures, its judicial structures were lacking and were incapable of dealing with the most fundamental challenge or responsibility of any government, which is protecting the population. Equally important are the challenges posed by weak governance and poor accountability. As the country modernizes and its government works towards reestablishing itself as a source of authority, Mexico could become a critical partner in making immigration reform successful. A government in Mexico committed to the rule of law could become a natural source of regulation of migratory flows. And this is the critical point. Change in Mexico is altering reality, and a more functional structure of governance is being built. Americans, I believe, need to see Mexico and its Central American neighbors as reliable partners in the long-term development of the whole region. And this is ultimately why it is all about competitiveness, which is the point being stressed in the report over and over. All of this would make economic growth and people movements all successful and legal affairs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure for me to be a part of this study group. And I feel a little bit today like when I was in Congress, I had a colleague named Mo Udall, 1 year ran for president. And this one political rally, he was the last speaker among many, many candidates, and it was almost midnight by the time he was called on to speak. And he started his remarks by saying, everything that needs to be said has been said, but not everybody has yet said it. And so I have the privilege of being the last speaker, but I think what I'm been asked to talk about is something that's been mentioned, but has not been emphasized as much as I think it should be. If we're going to have a competitive region in this global economic area. When I left Mexico and visited with President Clinton, he asked what my advice was in going forward and what should be done. And my comments were that if the enormous democratic political advances and reforms in Mexico and the very positive economic reforms that have taken place, that they're going to be sustained and strengthened. The most important thing, in addition to the rule of law, the most important thing that they and all of us can invest in is education, health, and infrastructure. And the most important of those is education. I met with many of the, particularly in southern Mexico, the other half of the Mexican economy that basically was left out of NAFTA and the benefits of NAFTA. And I met with various individuals, and without exception, what they wanted most in life was a better life for their children and their grandchildren. And they recognized that the way they achieve that is through education, and they were not getting it at that particular time. To the credit of the Peña Nieto government this year and the bipartisan support of the Congress in Mexico, they passed a major Education Reform Act. And I think it's going to have a significant difference in the future and the opportunity for Mexico going forward. There have been some improvements in education in Central America, no question about it. But when you look at the region of the whole, as a whole, and when you compare that region particularly to the area of Asia, which for decades now has emphasized education and quality education and relevant education, we're not competitive. We're not competitive as a region, and we should know that. So we need major education reforms, not just in Central America and Mexico, but in the United States also, if we're going to be competitive in this global economy. And the study group calls for that, not only in primary education, but also in education at a higher level, in areas of science and technology and engineering and mathematics. We're woefully short in what we ought to be if we're going to be the most competitive region in this world. And that's the opportunity we have to give to our children and our grandchildren. That is the most important thing that we can do in terms of creating a better quality of life. Now, if our Congress, the U.S. Congress, through stupidity or irresponsibility or high degree of partisanship, fails to deal with the immigration reforms that are pending up there now, this issue of immigration or migration is not going to go away. It's going to be with us for a long time here to come. But if we seize the opportunity, as I think we can and we will, if we seize the opportunity and give a particular emphasis to the role of education, not only the education in the basics, but the education in the relevancy, how does it relate to the needs of global economic needs at the present time, and how do we train and retrain our young people and our workers for that, to take advantage of that opportunity. If we do that in U.S., Mexico, and Central America, we will be the most competitive region in the world. We have the natural resources, and we have resources and human resources. All we need to do is to fine-tune that and give them the education they need. So it's been a pleasure to be a part of this, and we look forward to your questions. Thank you.
It's almost unbelievable that not only has every member of this panel stuck within their time frame, which is remarkable to me at least, but they also punctuated the most important elements of what the report is all about. The report is focusing on the future, but we cannot get there from here unless we all apply ourselves in the areas that the members of the panel discussed. Education, and as the ambassador mentioned, quality, but also relevance. I don't want to make too many people unhappy here, you know, but perhaps we ought to consider that we may have enough PhDs in political science or international affairs. And perhaps we need many more people who are engineers and scientists and mathematicians. In fact, the two presidents of Mexico and the United States had an agreement that focuses on these kinds of occupation. You've heard President Zedillo and Secretary Gutierrez and, of course, Vice President Stein make extremely important points about what it is that we need to do now, begin to make the investments now that will take us to a different future than the one that we have encountered in the past 20 or 30 years. If the essence of this report were to be reduced to just a few words, the words could be change, opportunity, and hope. Change requires us that we look at things the way that they are, not the way that they were 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago. We have to look at the extraordinary changes that have taken place in so many countries of the region. If you look at education rates in Mexico and El Salvador, and of course Guatemala and Honduras, and how much effort they are making. If you look at the kinds of investments that have been made, if you look at the effect that NAFTA has had in the relationship with Mexico, $500 million in two-way trade. And if you think that this is an impressive number, let me give you two numbers that are far more impressive than that, particularly for the United States. Almost 44% of that total trade is U.S. trade to Mexico. In no other country, in no other bilateral trading relationship do we approach anything like that. In fact, most of the other bilateral trading relationships that we have are extremely heavy on the other side, what they sell to us. Over 40% of every product produced in Mexico that comes to the United States, 40% of the content of that product is American. The comparable figure for Canada is 25%. Everything else is further down the line. These are extremely important changes that most people are not aware of. You know, we have made up our mind, perhaps all too easily, about what the region looks like, what the opportunities might be, and we focus all too much on the challenges, and the challenges are real. No one will say that they're not, and you heard them here. Public security, the security of individuals, a critical element of governance, of good governance. The institutional reforms that need to continue to be made, the commitment to the rule of law that needs to get to be deeper and deeper, economic and social development that we need to focus on more and more to make a true commitment to. All of those things will be taking place. But the study group has focused on the opportunities. The opportunities that have been created because of changes that have already taken place. And the biggest opportunity we see is to start thinking together about what kinds of skills, how can we equip our citizens, each country doing so on its own, but also thinking laterally, thinking within the region. How can we equip our people This way they can succeed. When our people succeed, the country grows. When people really want to hold on to their middle class status, they make demands of their government. They create opportunities for investors. The more investors, the more purchases, the more confidence, the greater the opportunities for a country become. And when those opportunities begin to spread, the region profits. This is not going to be easy. So the last word that I mention in this part of my remarks is hope. We're all hopeful that those things can happen. We think that the elements, the ingredients are already there. We just need to work hard at them. I think we have political leadership now all across the region that can make a commitment and pursue that commitment as we move forward. Ultimately, if human capital is the ultimate resource, as we all say it is, let's hope we believe it. If indeed is the ultimate resource, let's try to make sure that we build that resource up and that we're committed to a better future for the region. Thank you very much. There's an awful lot more in the report. Too many words, perhaps. But it is done in a smart way. You can read the executive summary, which is really a complete record of the report, and the recommendations. And the recommendations touch on all of the topics that have been raised here by this superb panel. This has been a great opportunity for us at the Migration Policy Institute and with our colleagues, Andrew Seeley and Cindy Arnson over there. We have been very proud to work with them and produce this particular report. Thank you. And now we'll open the floor up for comments, questions, etc., etc.
All right, we now revert to the stage. No more up and down. And open the floor to questions, but I want to just underscore what's been said in a variety of different ways. Many of the people in this audience are people who follow migration issues, and of course we have come to this through a migration lens. But one of the paradoxes of all of this, and one of the things that's difficult in terms of policy and action moving forward, is that what this says and what we know is that solving our migration problems and harnessing migration for more positive effects in all of our societies requires moving well beyond migration into many other policy realms, particularly education, training. But this is really cross-cutting from the standpoint of how one mobilizes societies and moves an agenda like this. So we really are, as Dimitri said, taking a stab, perhaps with too many words, perhaps in some cases more general than needs to be, but really trying to push the envelope into the ways in which migration connects within our societies with so many other endeavors in order then to create the dynamics and feedback loops that ultimately create a much more positive migration picture. Questions?
Hi, my name is Mario Hernandez. I'm the Director of Public Affairs at Western Union. I work with a lot of immigrants here in the U.S. and internationally, in Mexico and Central America. And I would like to raise the issue of immigrant entrepreneurship. Secretary Gutierrez talked about the circularity and how immigration reform will create jobs here in the U.S. and how important it is to create economic opportunities back home. So immigrants are entrepreneurs, and not only workers, but I know a lot of people that have come here to the U.S., and they are creating jobs in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and many places. So I think that the issue of immigrant entrepreneurship should be encouraged, promoted, and supported. But Secretary Gutierrez also mentioned that many people are thinking about going back home. And these immigrants are, after spending some years here in the U.S., after saving money, they want to create jobs in their home communities. So the diaspora investment should be something that should be promoted, encouraged, and supported. And if you have any comments regarding this, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
I think everything you mentioned is right on target. You know, when we had a legal system for immigration that was right for the times, we have to go back a long time, there was a lot of circularity and very positive circularity. People would come and work for several years and then go home with a few dollars, perhaps some new skills that would be applied in that economy and would be a benefit to the region. Today, circularity has almost stopped because our legal system is broken. People don't want to leave because they may not be able to get back in. So all of the unintended consequences that you can imagine are happening today because our legal system is not working. That's why the first step is immigration reform, and that's why we support the Senate bill, and we think that needs to get through as quickly as possible so we can have a foundation that we can build on. But I agree with what you said, and very good points. Thank you.
Let me add perhaps a couple of data that may demonstrate the point that Secretary Gutierrez just made. You know, until the 1950s, over 50% of the people who had immigrated to the United States had actually gone back. So people do not always come, work here, build families here, retire here, and die here. Part of the reason that in the last 20 years or so we have seen a pattern that is moving more in the direction of what I just said, come, stay, et cetera, is because we have an immigration system that does not really look very favorably upon mobility. It locks people in, whether it's the border, the hardening of the borders, or for that matter, the visa system, the way it exists. This is not going to change dramatically. We're still an immigration country. Our narratives are all about people wanting to do all of the things that we discussed, you know, including retiring here and dying here. But increasingly, a small but growing proportion of immigration is going to be more like mobility immigration rather than immigration. And I think what the Secretary was very articulate and insistent in including in the report, and the report, I think, does a good job of discussing this. We have to create opportunities for people to actually go back, invest some of their savings, fail, and still be able to come back. I mean, ultimately, this is what you want to create if you're going to think about the opportunities and the advancement of the region.
Let me add just a couple of points to Mario's question and what Dimitri and the Secretary have already said. One is I think if you look at the numbers, there's a disproportionate amount of small business creation done by immigrants in this country. This is done by both well-educated immigrants, high-tech, all of that, but also by less educated immigrants. I mean, there is something about immigrant entrepreneurship that has worked in this country, and it goes back decades, if not longer. In this country, and it continues to work. Immigrants are disproportionately likely to go out and start small businesses. If you look at patents, particularly on the high end, and here we're talking about higher educated immigrants, but on patents also disproportionately immigrants play a role in this. On the returning side, and I know, Mario, you've been involved with some of these experiments, there is a growing number, this happens organically, of immigrant organizations, particularly in Mexico and El Salvador, but also in Guatemala and Honduras, who support small business creation back home. People have invested, they've saved up $20,000, $40,000, and they begin to invest it in their small communities back home. Some of these fail, some of these succeed, but increasingly there is a movement towards organizations doing this. In Mexico, we've seen support from some states like Zacatecas and the Mexican government. I see Dr. Arnulfo Valdivia over here. To actually try and support these initiatives as well in ways that allow them to become sustainable and allow small businesses to look for new markets to figure out how to get registered legally. So there's a lot, we can do in this country. We've seen some states try and encourage small business creation by immigrants and help immigrants navigate the legal framework. There's a lot could be done in Mexico and Central American countries in terms of helping immigrants here who have some capital to invest back home actually be successful when they invest, right, and make sure that these businesses actually plus up. Not going to change the whole economy, but it may change small towns that have no other opportunities. In addition to that, you have the circularity question, how you figure out people who have actually come to this country and worked for a while can go back home and then plug themselves in productively in their chosen profession in Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador. And so that's something that all of our countries need to think about together. But there's some huge opportunities.
One more thing about circularity. There are 1 million U.S. immigrants in Mexico that are also part of circularity. They're there for 2 years, 4 years, 6 years. They come back to the U.S., and they also come back with new skills. So it works both ways.
I think I said right over here.
Good morning. I'm Jill Wheeler from Hispanic Access Foundation. And thanks for such a fascinating report. And I'm very interested to hear more about how you see some of these recommendations being implemented. What areas, since they are so complex, crossing agencies, countries, where do you see the most potential, and where can civil society leaders support and take action around the implementation of these recommendations?
All right, Dimitri, you take a shot at that.
Yeah. You will see that the report, because it has to be a conservative report, meaning we do not want to be talking, up in the air, in the rarefied part of the atmosphere, so that people say, well, this doesn't make much sense. We have identified 3 or 4 areas, sectors, if you will, which have been growing and will continue to grow, we think, throughout the region, where each of the countries of the region have been making sustained investments in. And they are, area sectors that make an awful lot of sense. For instance, the entire health delivery system. We're not talking about doctors, but we're talking, from nurses' assistants to nurses. Logistics. Everybody wants to move produce and products throughout the region. And we need to do this efficiently, and we need to do it in a way that product or produce gets from point A to point B, however far it is, very expeditiously. Advanced manufacturing. Mexico is producing more engineers today, I think, than the United States is. So these are areas in which we're all investing, and there is an enormous advantage to us to begin to think together about how to invest smartly on that. The way we do that, we suggest, is by having some pilot programs initially where some of these people get educated and trained to common standards. This is very difficult to do. That's why we suggest that we start with pilot projects. But we already have identified some unions, universities, etc., who are really keen to try to do that. So, I'm sorry about the noises. So the whole idea there is to begin to demonstrate through pilot projects, I'm not moving at all, through pilot projects that this can be done, that mutual advantages can happen, and I will stop talking because maybe as I, punctuate my words, the microphone is unhappy. Oh. And Michelle says.
Also, your question dealt with what's the next step and what can you do about it. I think you start in this country with the immigration bill that's pending before the Congress. And there, NGOs and private citizens and different groups like that can play an enormous role in moving that along, because all of those who've been negative on any kind of immigration, enlightened immigration policy, you can be sure are up there now, are going to continue to put pressure on
members of Congress, and so you have to build a political backfire to give the other side of the story. I think in the other countries, Central America and Mexico, the same kind of political action needs to be taken. And in Mexico, for example, the NGOs, when I went there as ambassador, had zero effect in influencing their government. And they felt they had zero effect. Now I think it's much different. And so expressing yourself to your governments and encouraging all the governments, as Dimitri said, to start coordinating, build these pilot projects. This issue of English language, which we also emphasize in the report, it's not that we are trying to enforce English on everybody else. The fact is, English is the language of business. English is the language of investment all around the world. And if you are ignorant in that language, you're going to not have the same opportunities. So putting pressure on your own governments is very, very important.
Yeah, this is one of the typical areas in which we need a regional understanding of how the problems are evolving and what the solutions that are working in particular circumstances. And even if Dimitri doesn't like political scientists for what he said before, we do need a very high level of political dialogue amongst not only our governmental officers, but also amongst the people who can delve into the solutions. And let me give you just a simple example. In the so-called war against drugs, and we're trying to move away from these type of concepts, the emphasis on interdiction that the United States has placed on the rest of the region implies a burden on domestic budgets in many countries, requiring loads of money with dubious effectiveness in different areas of security controls, money that could be dedicated to education, to infrastructure, to health services, etc. So we need to share amongst ourselves strategic visions on how to better allocate our resources, although each country responds to very specific domestic pressures.
I just want to add one example to build on what Dimitri just said. If you take the example of a nurse or a nurse's aide, we should be capable of ensuring that the education of a nurse in Mexico, that those standards fit the requirements of a nurse in the U.S. And if we have a shortage of nurses, which we do, then there has to be a mechanism whereby we can work together to have that positive circularity, because the nurse may stay for 4 years, go back to Mexico with new skills, and that's how we foresee the future and the kind of collaboration across governments.
Mr. Ambassador, did you have a question, comment? No? Okay. Here in the middle.
Thank you. My name is Silvia Lara from Costa Rica. I came all the way from Costa Rica just to be here today. I work for an organization in Costa Rica called the Business Association for Development. I'm the director. And there are similar organizations in all countries in Central America. We're doing corporate social responsibility. And we think migration has all to do with being responsible with society. I'd like to know, what are the plans, or better, are there any plans to share and discuss the report's conclusion with the region, and not just governments and migration authorities, but also with the private sector and civil society? Because we really need to take this discussion this approach to our countries. Thank you.
Well, let me begin that answer, and then I think maybe Dimitri might want to amplify it. In the first place, the report is being translated into Spanish, so it will be fully available. Secondly, we will be doing a trip to the region. We will be going to Mexico. We will be going to Central America in the next 2 months or so, for the purposes that you outline. This is a discussion that needs to happen throughout the region, and it certainly needs to happen within Central America and within Mexico. So we will try to be a catalyst for that. We'd love to see you afterwards. We very much see this as a document and as a conversation starter on things that need ultimately to be owned by each of our societies individually and then collectively. Dimitri, do you want to add?
Yes, this is a superb comment, and I don't know whether I'm sorry that your head fly all the way to here from Costa Rica, or thank you for it. But the business community is a critical element in this. In crafting some of the report, we had in mind clearly what the Europeans call the social partner. Worker organizations must participate in this. The business community must be integral, not participate in this. Integral as we move forward in this. And stakeholders of all types, including civil society, or particularly civil society, must do what civil society at its best does well, which is hold governments and the other actors accountable, push for the kinds of things that governments and the business community and worker organizations know that they have to do, if we're going to move to the future that we have in mind and that the report proposes.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Dustin Manhart, and I worked in older adult services in Southern California for the last 10 years, and I thought it was really interesting to hear these statistics in Guatemala and Honduras, how the population, 70% is over the age of 30. As you probably all know, there's an aging tsunami in the United States where our population is growing or aging very quickly. I was curious as to what the population looks like in Mexico and kind of maybe what you guys have looked at as far as what opportunities there might be and how many of these older adults kind of go back and forth between Mexico and the United States and other countries. And then just a second question, a brief question, just out of curiosity. I know in professional soccer, you see a lot of Mexican national teams scouting players, Latinos here in the United States, and vice versa. You see a lot of players switching national teams. So it seems like maybe they're maybe a step ahead in seeing a lot of individuals going back and forth. Just curious if you looked at that at all in your study. Thank you.
Sports has a way of doing that. Luis, would you like to comment on that?
Two things quickly. The demographics in Mexico have changed dramatically. The population growth or the birth rate is slightly above what demographers call the, fertility replacement rate. So there will come a moment, a time in the not too distant future where we will not have as many Mexican immigrants, and Mexico will have to become an immigrant receiving country. Also, strategically looking at the skills that they need in order to be able to grow. That is a tremendous change. And that's why part of our recommendation is that these countries also modernize their immigration systems to get ready for that future. The other positive side of circularity, because we call it positive circularity, we believe is extremely positive, is that we're also mindful of the so-called brain drain. So that's why we say an example of the nurse, we don't want to take every nurse away from Mexico, but it would be great if, through this positive circularity, if after a period of time, they went back to Mexico, or Guatemala, Salvador, Honduras, with more skills and contributed to their country. Again, positive circularity.
Luis? Andrew?
Two issues. The report emphasizes something very, very significant that, that Secretary Gutierrez has mentioned twice. And the notion of circularity has not existed largely because it's so difficult to come back to the U.S. that nobody wants to leave. So that has created an enormous incentive for people to come, bring their families and stay. Whereas if they are only coming to work temporarily, temporarily might mean a year or two or several, but they have the certainty that they can go and come back, then they have no incentive to bring their families, and they, everybody can remain back in their place of origin. So the issue, the big issues that are being discussed and have been discussed in the last couple of decades in the U.S. would no longer exist if that process were certain. The other point that I'd like to drive at, and I think that's what's the most innovative part of this report, is that it is taking the region as a whole. It's looking at overall economic development. How can the economies of the region complement each other so that everybody wins as a result? And that means introducing significant changes and reforms, not only in the issue at hand in the U.S. in migration, immigration reform, but also in the areas that have been emphasized and mentioned here several times, in economic development, in growth, in the rule of law, in accountability, in governance, in the other countries. Mexico has daunting challenges in establishing the rule of law, in dealing with the political decentralization that started 20 years ago, but has nonetheless not built the kind of institutions that need to exist for a decentralized society to operate. Those kinds of things have to be worked out. And that's the kind of thing that the report emphasizes, and I think that's why it's such an interesting and an innovative concept in as a whole.
Just a clarification, and I apologize for my mismanagement of the English language. Guatemala and Honduras, together with Nicaragua, have a demographic profile in which 70% of the population is below 30 years of age.
Yeah, no, you got it.
Yeah. Whereas Salvador has curbed down their fertility rate considerably. Sorry.
Let me just add one thing to your question. Of the roughly 1 million U.S. immigrants living in Mexico, probably a majority, a very large percentage, are those who are living in retirement there. And they're doing it for a variety of reasons. But that is an enormous economic opportunity for Mexico and Central America in the future. But that requires skills, not only in nursing skills, but also skills and new technology in delivering health care and things like that. So you have, first in the United States, an aging population. You have in Mexico, soon to be an aging population, and you have the needs there, and the cost of health care is getting larger and larger. So there's going to be more of a draw into Central America, and that's going to be a major economic opportunity for that region.
Yes. I don't want to take the... Okay, let me just say three things. The one follows exactly on what Jim said. You know, people very often think about talent and skills in zero-sum games. This is a positive-sum game that we're promoting. More nurses, increasing the supply of nurses, since the examples are in nursing. Not only because the United States is aging, but because before Mexico knows it, it will be aging. Mexico is at the end of its demographic transition. Two things are happening. Not only will fewer and fewer new workers be entering the labor market of Mexico, but more and more workers will be leaving it as they age out of the workforce. These people will need nursing services, and that's extremely important. But because of the way the health costs have been going in the United States and Mexico and other parts of the world, one of the greatest opportunities that I am sure smart people in Mexico have already figured it out is to actually provide in strategic locations all sorts of medical services, not just for the aged.
the same way that people today go to all sorts of different parts of the world. They go to India to have an operation at a cost that's one-fifth or one-tenth of what it costs to do so in the United States. And often they're operated upon by people who have graduated from American universities. The world is changing. That's what we're trying to emphasize here. That is why English is important. That is why common standards are important. That is why we have to be thinking in a very near future, at a time where Mexico and us are likely to be competing for other workers from the region, rather than us worrying about Mexicans coming to the United States to work outside of legal frameworks. And Mexico is already an immigration country and on its way to becoming a significant immigration country. See, if recent history around the world has taught us anything, is that what used to take 30 or 50 years to happen, which is a country leisurely becoming an immigration country, those things now take 10, 15 years. Once the opportunity, in other words, once all the basic ingredients for a country to become a major immigration country occur, and Mexico already has most of them, countries actually fill up with immigrants seeking the same kind of opportunity that Mexicans have sought in the United States in the past 30 or 50 years.
Okay, we're going to have that have to have been the last question, I'm sorry to say, so we'll invite the rest of you who might want to ask questions to come forward after the event, and we'll have a one-on-one conversation. But I'm going to turn now to Andrew to give us a concluding send-off.
Well, thank you to Doris and Dimitri and everyone at the Migration Policy Institute for all the work in putting this together. On behalf of the Wilson Center, it's been a great privilege. And let me say special thanks to the co-chairs and the members of the study group. This was really a very dynamic a group over time. We had two processes going on. One was the group coming up with all sorts of ideas on what need to be researched and the research going on, and then bringing this to a close and thinking, what are the recommendations here, which is what you've seen today. So there's a great body of work. If you haven't seen it yet, go back and look at some of the research reports, which are really standalone exercises that deal with some of the specific issues in the report, but also look at the report itself that really brings some of the cutting-edge issues here. Let me finish with a few of the words that have been spoken by the other panelists here. Let's start with hope. Dimitri has said this is a moment of hope. Opportunity is a word that you heard several times. This is a time where demographics are changing in Mexico and Central America. Economic prospects are changing. Perhaps violence patterns are changing. It's less clear. But it is a moment of hope and opportunity in those countries, not without challenges, as we've heard from some of the panelists. It's also a moment of hope and opportunity in this country. It's a moment where we are talking about these issues. And it is a time where there's hope and opportunity to think together creatively about how do we get beyond migration as a problem and begin thinking of migration as an opportunity to enhance our competitiveness and to create jobs in all of these countries. Positive circulation, you've heard from Secretary Gutierrez several times, the notion that we can actually create positive circularity among our countries. Some people will still immigrate, and we want to be an immigrant country in this country. We always have been, we always will be, but also positive circularity, which allows people to come and go and perhaps develop skills along the way. Economic growth, and I will come back once again to hope. This is a time where we could start having some of the big conversations. Yes, we will be for the next few months embroiled in very specific conversations in the U.S. Congress about immigration reform in Mexico and in the Central American countries. There are very specific conversations going about real challenges that people face and real challenges for policy. But this is a moment of hope and opportunity where we can begin to think big. Hopefully this report puts some ideas on the table that are creative, that are a little bit out of the box, and that are worth a conversation within this region and that we're only starting to have. So thank you again to the co-chairs and to the members of this study group, and thank you to all of you for attending.
For more information on the Migration Policy Institute's Regional Migration Study Group, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/regionalstudygroup.